As you know, beloved listeners, I am an economic sub-literate. I'm still coping with the recent change to decimal currency in Australia. And on this particular case, my producers demand that I deal with Bitcoin. Heavens to Betsy. Last year, Bitcoin, the most famous of the virtual currencies, broke $1,000 per coin after Federal Reserve Chief Bernanke gave qualified praise for the virtual currencies before Congress. Now, bitcoins, which are apparently just strings of numbers, can be used to buy goods, services, by transferring them electronically across the internet. But with more polarizing debate than ever surrounding Bitcoin, it seems that the currency is only the tip of the iceberg. In fact, the raft of underlying technological innovations that created Bitcoin may be even more promising in themselves. Whatever, the experiment is far from over. Joining me to discuss the Bitcoin fuss is Yiannis Varoufakis. He's director of the Political Economy Division at the University of Athens and visiting professor, and he tells me he visits very frequently, the University of Texas, and he joins us from Austin. And from California, Andreas Antonopoulos, the Chief Security Officer for blockchain.info. That's a website that tracks Bitcoin activity. Gentlemen, I welcome both of you to our little Australian wireless program. I understand, Andreas, that the alleged inventor of the Bitcoin protocol, Nakamoto, is that true? Is there a Nakamoto?
Well, yeah, the Nakamoto is a pseudonym, and Newsweek did a big splash that they think they found him, but all of the evidence points to shoddy journalism, and they doxed essentially an innocent man and just brought a lot of attention in his life unnecessarily.
So Nakamoto is a pseudonym for what, an individual or a group?
Well, nobody knows that, really, but it doesn't really matter because the invention is essentially a mathematical equation and a system of coordinating activities on the Internet that is completely independent of the inventor. The system does not rely or is not controlled by the inventor. So most Bitcoiners really don't care. The whole point of Bitcoin is there is no central authority.
Andreas, I take it that the invention from whomever was quite altruistic and noble in concept or in ideal.
Well, the system itself was really quite technocratic. It was a system. It was designed as an electronic system for digital cash that allows people to allocate resources across the internet and send money from one person to another without relying or having to trust anyone in the middle. And that's quite a revolutionary invention in distributed systems because it allows for something that couldn't be done before, a distributed consensus system at large scale.
Let me ask you this, Yiannis. Do you see Bitcoin as a boon to civilization or a problem?
I see it as a brilliant answer in search of a worthy problem. It is a breathtaking solution to a problem we haven't discovered yet.
I'm sorry, I just can't help laughing. Please continue.
Look, for those who are unschooled in technical matters and don't even want to be schooled, like you, Philip, and to some extent me too. What I think it's important to keep in mind about Bitcoin is that it is a piece of mathematics, a beautiful piece of mathematics, which makes possible the creation of a decentralized network within which trust can be built, simply because everyone is monitoring everyone else. There is no sentry. There's no guardian. There is no Hobbesian Leviathan. there's no Leviathan that can be turned tyrannical or fall asleep on the job like the Fed did before 2008. Instead, what you have, in terms that I think you can understand, is a kind of Benthamite panopticon, where everyone is kept honest because everybody else is watching every activity, every exchange, every transaction. What it is not is a sound foundation for alternative money.
So I'm not entirely wrong, perhaps, in suspecting that there was a certain amount of altruism in its creation?
I don't think there's altruism is the word, because the only way the developer of Bitcoin, of the algorithm, could make it work is if he or she or they put it about in the internet, allowed it to float, to become part of the internet commons, so that then it could take root and grow into this decentralized network. It is not something you could sell, because by very definition, this is meant to be a decentralized community it is created by Bitcoin and which collectively supervises Bitcoin. So it could never have been proprietorial.
Yeah, it helps to think of Bitcoin not as money for the internet, but as the internet of money, a platform on which financial services and financial instruments can be built. And currency is just the first application. And in fact, if we don't like the way Bitcoin is implemented as a currency, there's already about 150 other currencies based on the same invention. And many of them look very favorable, especially compared to some of the 190 or so national currencies, many of failing at the moment.
So, Andreas, you are saying that what we're witnessing is the beginning of a whole new global and social dynamic.
Without a doubt, we're already seeing its application as a global transnational currency, primarily for a store of value in large volume transactions. But we're going to see many variations on this theme, because once you have a decentralized basis for trust, you can do some very interesting things. From the simplest applications, like, for example, registering your bicycle in a decentralized database so no one can steal it without having to have a single company manage that and making that global. All the way to doing a land registry with title and deed, or a currency. All of those things are possible now because of the internet of money that is the Bitcoin invention.
Yanis, why should I sink my pitiful ABC salary into Bitcoin at $1,000 a coin?
You shouldn't. Stay away from it. Bitcoin, you know, is not for the faint-hearted. Bitcoin is, there is a big tragedy here with Bitcoin, which has two folds. My lot, economists, fail to recognize the brilliance of it, the brilliance of the algorithm, and the fact that it has a great deal of potential. And the Bitcoin cheerleaders abide by a very primitive and dangerously flawed economic theory of money, and lure people like you, or people who are possibly a bit younger than you are.
Which is 90% of the human population, yes.
Yes. Into a kind of tulip mania. They present it as an alternative form of money. It's not even a currency, but it does have tremendous potential. As I was implying earlier, for changing parts of social organization that we haven't even imagined yet, how it could be changed by this kind of technology.
This is a discussion or a chat between an ignoramus, that's me, a skeptic, and an advocate. And so I'm going to put the same question to you, Andreas. Why should I buy into Bitcoin at $1,000 a coin?
Well, for one thing, I'd like to clarify the fact that you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin and you don't have to buy a whole one, and Bitcoin can be divided into smaller and smaller quantities. But I would echo what Yanni said, which is you shouldn't. This is not something that is necessarily for the faint-hearted, and it's something that is still highly experimental. I get my entire income at the moment in Bitcoin because I'm part of this economy and it works very well for me. There are going to be other currency and other monetary policies encoded in other currencies based on this invention, which may not be, for example, deflationary in nature as Bitcoin is. Most important thing is now people have a choice. So the very fact that you're asking that question and you have that choice as an individual is incredibly empowering, especially if you do it on a worldwide basis where 5 to 6 billion people have very limited access to international finance and international banking, and these types of currencies connect them to the rest of the world. So don't do it yet, but at some point in the future, you may find that your preferred method of exchanging value with the rest of the world is as simple as an email, and it's based on the invention of the blockchain. It might not be Bitcoin, it might be Bitcoin. We've yet to find out.
Now, Yanis, in a sense, all the currency that's whizzing around the world is effectively digital, isn't it? More than 90% of dollars, euros, frequent flyer points are familiar examples of, digital currencies.
Yes, of course. The vast majority of currency units are in digital form, but the fundamental profound difference between that, everything you mentioned, and Bitcoin is that in the case of Bitcoin, there is no central bank standing behind it. There is no regulation. Nobody is keeping records centrally of transactions. And that makes it exceptionally exciting and at the same time fundamentally and profoundly flawed. Because let's not forget, Philip, that the reason why we do have central banks, the reason why we have moved away from the primitive gold standard in the past was that those unregulated metallic systems where governments were not supposedly prevented themselves or were not allowed by politicians, by the powers that be, the lords of the land and so on, to print money, those systems failed spectacularly. They produced one depression after the next in the 19th century. And in the end, the reason why the Federal Reserve in the United States was instituted, and then its role was beefed up with the FDIC that backs banks and provides deposit insurance and all that, was the 1929 disaster.
This is Anna Nell on RN, and we are delving into the world of the Bitcoin with Yanis Varoufakis and with Andreas Antonopoulos. And before I go back to Andreas, Yanis, you've mentioned the gold standard. Please explain to the simple creature that the Bitcoin seems to be modelled on the gold standard, in a sense mimicking the finite state of a natural resource.
Indeed. The idea behind the gold standard was that there should be a fixed amount of currency issued per ounce of gold that the nation owned, its government owned, or that was floating around in the economy. And the purpose of that was to prevent politicians from inflating the currency, printing as much money as they needed for their own grubby purposes. So the idea was to tie it to the quantity of gold, which politicians, of course, by definition, could not inflate, because there is a limited amount of gold, and the politicians do not have any control over the rate of extraction. That meant that the quantity of paper money was rather inflexible. The upside was that the rate of inflation was kept quite low, but capitalism could not breathe in the straitjacket of the gold standard, and very often it went through major spasms, with the greatest one being 1929. 1929 was the failure of the gold standard to keep up with the pace of development due to the creation of the large corporations like the Ford Motor Company, Edison, and so on and so forth. The reason why we don't have the gold standard anymore and we don't tie the quantity of money to some non-economic, apolitical, non-governmental magnitude like gold, like the algorithm of Bitcoin and so on, is that this straitjacket is bound to cause massive social costs.
Andreas, tell me please about this concept of the shared public ledger, the blockchain. What's the blockchain?
So the simplest way to think of it is as an accounting ledger that shows, for example, that I have transmitted one coin from myself to Yanis, and that transaction is then publicly verified by a common consensus system and then is recorded in the public ledger. And this ledger is visible to everyone. The way it works is it allows people to therefore transmit money electronically in seconds across the world for pennies. And that is an incredibly powerful mechanism, whether it's tied to limited monetary supply or not, because keep in mind, Bitcoin is one implementation of that, but there are many other currencies based on the blockchain that have different monetary characteristics, some of them inflationary, some of them not tied to a fixed and limited supply. All of these things really are recorded in this ledger, so everyone can validate that transaction, and then because there is a distributed consensus system, a system of trust that is spread out across all the participants, no one can fake a transaction in the ledger. That's the basic concept.
So there is no way of having counterfeit bitcoins as something that almost every other currency faces as a threat.
That is correct. And in fact, the important invention is that you can prevent counterfeit coins and you can manage money supply without having a central trusted authority that can be manipulated or corrupted. And in that asset ledger, you could transfer a Bitcoin, or you could transfer ownership of a bicycle, or you could transfer ownership of a stock certificate, or you could transfer ownership of pretty much anything, and you could base the same system as trust. So it allows for the trade of assets and value across the internet, which is extremely empowering not just for people, but also it fuels the internet because it gives us a fundamental basis for doing monetary and economic transactions.
The voice of Andreas Antonopoulos in San Francisco. Let's go back to Yiannis Varoufakis in Austin, Texas. Let's go back to the skeptic. A response from you, please.
No, I mean, I have no objection to what Andreas said. The blockchain is a remarkable algorithm. It's a remarkable way of keeping track of transactions and preventing what is referred to as double spend. How do you stop someone from spending a digital unit of currency twice? The blockchain does this very beautifully. But having said that, there is a big security problem in the sense that even though you can't have counterfeit money, a hacker can hack into your computer and disappear in the middle of the night with all your bitcoins. And if you entrust these bitcoins to an unregulated Bitcoin bank, and it has to be unregulated if we're going to stay within this decentralized dream, then the banker may run away with your bitcoins or be hacked himself, which is exactly what happened a few weeks ago with Mt. Gox in Japan.
And that was a very large bank robbery, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. It was remarkably large by Bitcoin standards. It just goes to show how steadfast and enthusiastic the Bitcoiners are, that after 750,000 Bitcoins belonging to customers disappeared, and another 100,000, and we're talking about something equivalent now, around $500 million has disappeared in the middle of the night, and yet the Bitcoiners stick to it. It's a little bit of an ideology, Philip, and it's actually quite touching how they, you know, the Bitcoiners are attached to their community.
That was why I was making stumbling efforts to get into the emotion of Bitcoin as well as the algorithm. Now, Andreas, I understand, I accept the point that there's no central banking, terrific, but there are some quasi-official guardians of your blockchain there. And to complete the analogy of Bitcoin as a natural resource, they're called miners. Tell me about miners.
So I would like to point out that one of the things about Mt. Gox that Yiannis mentioned is that it was decentralized. In fact, it wasn't. It required people to give their money over to a centralized institution, and it failed because it had neither the blockchain regulation nor the banking regulation. So it does represent a failure of Bitcoin. In fact, we can see much more effective security mechanisms are already being developed at the moment for as part of this innovation growth. So mining, to answer your question, is a process by which trust is built into the network. It's a distributed competition that occurs every 10 minutes, and that competition ensures that transactions are correctly verified and gives the opportunity for someone to create a new entry in the ledger and write a number of transactions into the global ledger. And through this form of competition, it ensures that nobody can cheat because the incentives are aligned against cheating. And that system has worked remarkably well, both for issuing the currency and for securing all of the transactions in the blockchain database.
Yiannis, another ignorant question. Are its tentacles all pervasive? Is it coexisting with the ruble, for example? Is it living with the yen? Is it in China? Or is it a phenomenon pretty much of the Western world?
Oh, no. It is an international phenomenon. There was at some point about a year ago a massive infusion of value into the Bitcoin community from China, even though the Chinese authorities have taken a rather dim view of this and tried to stop it. But nevertheless, these things are not easy to stop simply because government doesn't like them and have no qualm with this idea. I do have a libertarian streak in me. It's very well hidden, but it's there somewhere. Or an anti-authoritarian one, let me put it this way. But the idea that you can have, that you can replace a fiat money with a cryptocurrency is, for me, quite dangerous. because it is not a question just that the Bitcoin currency community algorithm can be hacked. It can't be hacked. What can happen, as I said, is your own account can be hacked and you can lose your money. This is not the issue. These issues are going to be overcome through some protocol security protocol that the community itself institutes. The problem is what happens if Bitcoin does become macroeconomically significant. At the moment, it is utterly insignificant from a macroeconomic point of view. If it does become significant, then that will destabilize the world economy as we know it. And this is something that Bitcoin technical supporters and enthusiasts are not looking into, because I don't believe that they have an interest in understanding how capitalism works.
Andreas, who are the enemies of Bitcoin? You know, clearly it has a great many and a growing number of friends, but it must be ruffling the feathers of some fairly powerful groups or entities.
Right. There's this idea, in fact, that Bitcoiners are perhaps not interested in capitalism. But I think what Bitcoin threatens most of all is kleptocracy. And so at the moment, we have a parasitic class of financiers that got away with a great heist in 2008, and none of them went to jail. And in many countries, they ended up not only getting bailed out, but getting bailed out or bailed in by investor money, see what happened in Cyprus, or through completely out-of-control printing of money, as is happening at the moment in a number of emerging countries and in the U.S., which caused hyperinflation. So the existing world status isn't exactly rosy from a macroeconomic perspective. There are a lot of interests that are threatened in the parasitic class because this level of transparency that Bitcoin brings, as well as the fact that it removes the ability for organizations that sit in the middle of the centralized institutions of money, the regulators, the central banks, etc., to exhibit rent-seeking behavior, where they have a cozy relationship with a regulator and they can secure 0% loans. And that is really a perversion of capitalism. It ends up sapping all other economic activity because it's cheaper just to get cheap money to do nothing. And that parasitic class is essentially causing stagnation across world economies. And they certainly don't want to lose the ability to exhibit this rent-seeking behavior. So I think it challenges them. But in the end, it doesn't really matter. There are no significant enemies to Bitcoin, I think, or other cryptocurrencies. It's just a matter of understanding and adapting to the change that has already happened. This invention has been invented. It's out in the world now. And the world will change because of it. So we simply need to understand how it will affect world economies, how it will affect international finance, and then adapt accordingly so that we can achieve the best outcomes.
Yiannis, I'm an old lefty, so I must say references to the parasitic class are somewhat heartwarming. Do you share that view?
No, I don't. Let me tell you why I don't, even though I have no objection to the diagnosis of a very sick and sickening Wall Street, City of London, Frankfurt banking community. Let's face it, if anything like Bitcoin is to challenge the bankers and fiat money and all that, they will have to create their own Bitcoin banks. The moment you start creating banks, there has to be some kind of backstop in case these banks go under. Otherwise, you're going to have major destabilization like 1929. And then, of course, you simply recreate the whole panoply of Wall Street behavior on the basis of Bitcoin. So there is not much point to that. And Philip, look, whenever we encounter ideological evangelists, behind them usually lurks a selfish aristocracy, and the Bitcoin community is no different. There is a Bitcoin aristocracy. The people, the early adopters, the ones who accumulated very cheaply Bitcoins at the beginning, they have every reason to talk this thing up and lure more people in a tulip-like mania or pyramid, making extravagant claims and invoking the troubles of people like the Cypriots, who were locked out of their banks for a week. There was, during that period, a cunning Bitcoin entrepreneur announced that he's going to open a Bitcoin ATM in Cyprus in order to save the Cypriots from their banklessness. And all that, of course, was just hype in order to exploit genuine concerns and fears that people have in the midst of a crisis that is ongoing since 2008.
Andreas, as you're a fine example of a Bitcoin aristocrat, so I'm giving you the final word. A last comment from you, please.
Oh, I certainly wouldn't call myself a Bitcoin aristocrat. I've actually spent a couple of years getting involved in this as a technologist because I find it a fascinating technology, and I did so without any income. So, I have no huge hoard of Bitcoin.
Quite a lot of aristocrats live in poverty these days, Andreas.
Right, I might be that kind of aristocrat, but here's the thing. I think the parasitic class in Wall Street, to use a term that you enjoy, is not necessarily going to be threatened by Bitcoin. I think what you're going to see is more like what happens with telecommunication companies during the development of the internet, which is that they have to adapt to an environment that's far less profitable, where they control less power. And in many cases, they will adapt to that, built upon new cryptocurrencies, and they will end up using the blockchain invention in order to build distributed systems of trust. I think bankers know how to do technology and how to manage money and consumer concerns about security and branding and things like that. So many of them will do very well. I think the ones that won't do very well are the ones that depend on essentially pure rent-seeking behaviors without adding much value to the economy. So I don't think Bitcoin threatens anyone, really, or, in fact, more importantly, the other cryptocurrencies that will follow and are following. I think Bitcoin will play a role very similar to digital gold, and other cryptocurrencies will become perhaps more suitable as everyday means of exchange, and eventually we'll find a role for governance and bankers to be involved in this in a massive way because they're going to adapt.
Gentlemen, I found this fascinating and exhilarating, and I thank you both. Andreas Antonopoulos, who's the Chief Security Officer of blockchain.info, it's a website which tracks Bitcoin activity, and Yanis Vodafakis, who's Director of the Political Economy Division at the University of Athens and Visiting Professor at the University of Texas. And Yanis, I'd like you to come back in the not too distant so we can discuss the vicissitudes of your fascinating and historic homeland. Thank you, gentlemen, and that's a wrap from Late Night Live for the week. Let me thank the team for their genius, and we'll be back next week. Oh, please stick around for the news. Thank you.